Sometimes change can feel scary, but it can also be exhilarating. A time to stretch our boundaries, embrace opportunity, and start something new. Welcome to the Baby Brunch Parenting Series, made just for you by BrightRock, the provider of the first ever needs-matched life insurance that changes as your life changes. This is a Baby Brunch podcast. Dr. Kira Knoll is a general practitioner who has recently relocated to start a new job. She has experience in pediatrics, emergency medicine, anesthetics, and primary care, with a special interest in holistic medicine and palliative care. A daughter was unexpectedly diagnosed with diamond black fan anemia, a rare and at times life-threatening bone marrow failure, and this was at 6 weeks of age. The experience of being the patient has hugely reshaped her approach to individual patients and the people that they care for. Together with her husband, who's also a doctor, a specialist surgeon, they have initiated steps to improve care in the field of rare blood disorders in Africa, and most importantly, to provide support to others with DBA.
Why did you move from Cape Town to Bloemfontein?
Well, my husband was offered a job at the academic hospital here at Universitas, which was a good opportunity for him, setting out on another path in his career to get some different experience. So, yeah, that's why we decided to make the move. It was quite a big thing for us to move from Cape Town and from our support base, but so far it's going well.
I want to talk about that again, because we're doing this interview for Baby Brunch on Skype, so I'm actually not seeing her. She's in Bloemfontein and I'm here in my studio, where I normally get to talk about moms who are just extraordinary and who do crazy, extraordinary things, like having a toddler who needs all our attention and then decide to relocate because we have dreams and aspirations too. Your husband's a specialist surgeon.
He is. He's a general surgeon and he's specializing in hepatobiliary, which is livers and pancreases and that part of the abdomen. So it's quite a demanding job, quite sick patients, but he's really enjoying his work here so far.
So let's backtrack. You wanted to start a family. You've met the man of your dreams. You make a beautiful couple, by the way. You do.
Thank you.
Tell me about your pregnancy. What was your pregnancy like?
It was actually great. You know, we tried for a little while to fall pregnant, so we were really excited when we found out I was pregnant. And, you know, actually, I loved being pregnant. If I look back on my pregnancy very fondly, and at the time, I really felt like, well, and things were going well, although it was not completely uneventful. In my 12-week scan, I screened quite high risk for Down syndrome. So that was a bit of a fright. We did the non-invasive prenatal testing, which excluded it. We were reassured everything was going to be fine. So we got over that hurdle quite easily. And then a bit late in the pregnancy, Olive wasn't growing so well. We thought it was possibly a placental problem. It could have still been. But in hindsight now, I think most of our issues were because of the fact that she had this genetic condition. Then at about 34 and a bit weeks, my gynae said to me, no, look, she's really not happy with the growth. She thinks I need to stop working. So she booked me off for some bed rest. She said, have a chocolate every day, do some fetal kicks. And I thought, okay, good, I can do it. And then I went in twice a week to see her for some monitoring. And actually, she did improve in that end of the pregnancy. And we were going to do a kind of an elective Caesar at about 35 weeks. Then we put it off because she did better. And then I eventually went into labor just after 36 weeks. So I had a Caesar then. She was breech. But yeah, you know, it was like a funny feeling. You get to the end of your pregnancy, I think, especially probably for your first pregnancy. There's so much hype and preparing the room and making sure everything's ready for the baby. You kind of think you've reached the finish line when the baby comes out and it's okay. But it's really just the beginning. It's just a drop in the ocean, that part. But I enjoyed my pregnancy very much.
What was it like? Because, I mean, I always joke with the girls and I say to them, I used to fight with my husband every Thursday. Only on a Thursday, because that's when I didn't feel so good. But, you know, also being the mom of a prem baby, I remember how hard it was coming home and not having my baby with me. When she arrived, what happened?
So when she was born, she was actually okay. She was 2.4 kgs. So she was a little bit little, but she came straight to the ward with me. She didn't have to go into NICU. She breastfed like an absolute champ, and she was fine. So she came home with us after 3 days, and things were actually going well. And I took her for weekly weight checks. She was growing well. She was feeding well. She was really, you know, everything was perfect. She was a good baby. Then at 6 weeks, just before 6 weeks, well, yeah, it was about 6 weeks, she was on the weekend. She kind of just wasn't herself. I couldn't put her down. And I thought, you know, is she having reflux? She just didn't want to lie down. She was very niggly. She kind of wasn't finishing her feeds. It was kind of like for like a day, you know, the Sunday. The Monday we went to see the peel. You know, I said to her, you know, we're like, oh, we're a bit worried. You know, she's not quite sort of herself at the moment. So Pete took one look at her and was like, oh, she's so pale. Which is also a funny thing because she was extremely pale. But, you know, we kind of, if I look at photos of her now, I think to myself, oh, gosh, she was so pale.
But you don't know any different when your baby's born.
Well, and I think it was insidious. She kind of became paler over those 6 weeks. So it wasn't like I saw her then and I saw her 6 weeks later. So you kind of don't notice the change so much. And I had actually thought, look, this child's quite pale, but they can get like a physiological anemia at 6 weeks, you know, especially if they're a bit prem. And I thought, oh, I was trying so hard not to be the anxious mum, you know. I think I felt like everybody expected me to be quite an anxious new mum.
Why is that? Because you're a doctor?
I think partly, and I think I previously have been quite an anxious person. This is something that's quite a funny thing. I find I get much less anxious now after this whole experience. But I think kind of people, my family and friends kind of anticipated me to be a little bit of an anxious mum, you know. And so I was really probably overcompensating about not being anxious. And so we were horrified when we heard that her HB was 3. I mean, that's really low. It should be like 15 for a baby that age. And she was actually in heart failure. And that's why she wasn't able to lie down. That's why she wasn't able to feed. And that was in the morning. I think it was a Monday morning. And we saw the peed. And she said, I'm going to do the bloods. You guys go home. I'm going to phone you. And we were not even home. And she phoned us and said, grab some stuff and come back. So we went straight back to the hospital. And just in that time in the hospital, you know, we waited. The ped came back to us in the ward to do some more bloods. The one thing was to send a cross match to the blood bank for a blood transfusion.
Already?
Already, because her HB was so low. That's really the only kind of treatment. So it was like an emergency transfusion, that one.
Okay, so go 2 steps back quickly because I've got so many questions. Was that the ped visit that we all go to after you've given birth? They say, bring the baby back with you. You need to?
Pretty much.
Oh my gosh. How long is she struggling for?
So it was really just, you know, I had that appointment and it was really just the day before that she actually became symptomatic, you know. I think she probably had dropped her HB maybe in the days preceding, but she only really became ill, you know, on the day before, if I think of it now. The other thing that we found on that admission was that her white cells were very low, her neutrophils, which are the bacteria fighting kind of part of your immune system, and she did have a UTI. So at the time there was a thought that maybe she got a UTI, which precipitated the whole thing. So it might have been that she got the UTI, which kind of made her crash at the time, you know what I mean? That could have been the precipitating factor. I don't know.
What is a UTI?
It's like a urinary tract infection, like a bladder infection. Yeah. She really did crash quite quickly. You know, that morning we were admitted and just waiting. She went to the general ward kind of, and then into high care. And then the ped said, oh, I think we must move you to the neonatal ICU. So that's when we went upstairs to the neonatal ICU. And she just really just deteriorated in front of our eyes during the course of that day. Her oxygen sats were low. She just didn't want to feed. She was completely lethargic. And we were holding out for the cross-matched blood. We could have given emergency blood from the fridge, but much better to cross-match the blood, much safer. So waited and waited, and the evening came. Eventually, my husband was started phoning the blood bank. They kept saying, because the nurses kept saying to us, it's on its way. Then he phoned a friend at the blood bank and said, listen, what's going on? And they said, there is no O negative blood. It's not on its way. So we were sitting there thinking, oh my goodness. Eventually, they found a unit at Tigerberg, which they sent through, an adult unit. She needed 30 mils of blood. That's all she needed. It's 2 tablespoons of blood. Because she was so little, but we waited 10 hours for that, and it was just about the longest 10 hours of my life.
So you were waiting for blood to match, and none of you are a match, both your husband and...
So I'm O negative, but at the time it was too late to, you know, to go and organize that. And the other thing is with using relatives' blood, If she, we didn't know at the time what the diagnosis was, but if in the long term she needed a bone marrow transplant, which may come from a family member, you don't want to kind of prime her to develop antibodies to that person's blood. You know what I mean? So it's actually preferential. There's almost a higher risk of rejection if the blood is quite similar, or, you know, graft versus host disease or whatever. So we have avoided using family members' blood.
Wow. So it's better for her to go through a blood transfusion route, like let's say, because in your area would have been Western Province Blood Service. So it would be better to get their blood than your own?
Exactly, yeah. So it was a stranger, I don't know, you know, somebody who donated blood. So her first few donations were like that. We had just random bloods, you know. So she had her first transfusion. She had another little bit of a top-up the next day. We went home. Oh, so that night, this was talking about the neonatal ICU thing. So we had her at home for 6 weeks. Then we couldn't stay with her in the NICU. So I left. We had to leave the NICU, I think, at 10 p.m. or something. So I left, and Colin sat outside until the blood arrived, and he knew that the transfusion had started. And then he came home. And, that was weird. It's amazing the space that a tiny baby takes up in your house, you know. And you think now is the opportunity to sleep the night through, but sure, I don't think either of us slept a wink. I think I called the NICU kind of every couple of hours to say, how's things? They were amazing, though. So that was that.
What's going through your mind when you are a doctor? Your husband is a surgeon. What goes through your mind when you work with people who need your help every day, and now it's your little baby that needs help?
It's hard, because it's an awkward position. And I know it's horrible having a patient who, particularly a patient whose parent or family member is a medical person, because they have a different insight. And, you know, and I know what the challenges are, and I know that things take time, et cetera, et cetera. But at the same time, you kind of feel like you are in a position where you should be able to mobilize resources a little bit, you know, and it's quite difficult to play each role individually, you know, the parent and the patient, and just sit there, or to try and be proactive. And, you know, you don't want to step on people's toes and what have you, but it's kind of, so I must say it's something it's tricky that we've navigated. We've been very, very blessed to have Olive's doctors who've been really, they are easy people. They're comfortable with involving us in the treatment plan and our opinions. And I think they realize that for us, this is something that we think about every day. You know, Colin has read every single drop of research about Down Black Fat Anemia, and most hematologists haven't, you know what I mean? Because it's so rare. They don't see it. So I think that we've been very, very blessed to have people who have been very kind of open to working with us as the parent and as the kind of co-medical team, which has been amazing.
At the time she was diagnosed with something, when did they know that it's Diamond Black Fan Anemia?
So after that first admission, we came home, she had antibiotics, etc. Then we kind of went back for follow-up blood tests, and her HB dropped again. We weren't sure at this time if it was like a viral infection or a genetic condition or leukemia. So we needed a bone marrow biopsy. Some people were reluctant to do it because she was still so little. They wanted to wait until she was 10 kgs or something. But I mean, I think she was like 3 kgs at that time. So it would have been so long to wait. So we found another awesome hematology pathologist who works in private in Claremont, and he said no, he'll do it for us. So she had a bone marrow biopsy under anesthesia when she was about 3 months old, I guess. No, it was not even that old. She was probably, because it was 6 weeks when she got sick. Yeah, it was probably a month later, so 2.5 months old. And he did the bone marrow biopsy, and he was also amazing. Very, very, as soon as he had some kind of news for us, he kind of phoned Colin to chat about it. He wasn't sure when he looked at it. He said there was just not a single red cell, lots and lots of immature white cells. So he sent the pictures to colleagues around the country as well, just to get it input, because he wasn't 100% sure it wasn't a leukemia. But they decided it wasn't a leukemia, but no red cells at all. So that started making the diagnosis of something like Diamond Black Fat Anemia more likely.
So explain it to us. So I mean, the first time I heard about it was when I met you. I have never heard of Diamond Black Fan Anemia. I mean, let alone the word. I can't even say it, because it's just not, it's unusual. Is it common? How come most people haven't heard about it? And what is it?
I had never heard of it. I went to look it up in our hematology, student hematology textbook, and there's a paragraph that's about 5 lines long. So it's really not something that anybody kind of thinks about, yeah. But it's basically an inherited or a congenital, not necessarily inherited, red cell aplasia, which means that the bone marrow doesn't make red cells. There's been quite a lot of research over the last few decades where they've found a number of genes. I think there's about 14 genes that are related. So not every child has the same genetic defect, but there are a number of genes that are involved in the production of blood cells. And these ones that are affected result in the syndrome. And it's also very variable. Patients with DBA, some of them are only diagnosed as an adult when they have a child who's got a severe anemia, and they do genetic testing and then they discover actually, oh, the mum's also got it, but she's been going around with an HB of 10 all her life and it hasn't really affected her. So it's very variable in its course and in its penetrance. And so it's quite a broad spectrum, you know what I mean, of a condition. But the bottom line is that they don't make red cells. That's kind of the classic presentation of it. A lot of them have got other anatomical abnormalities like digital hands and fingers that are abnormal, heart defects, kidney problems, that kind of thing. Olive didn't have any of the anatomical abnormalities. Some of them have other immunological abnormalities like the T cells and things, the immunoglobulin levels, which produces antibodies, might be affected. In Olive's case, her neutrophils are affected, so that's her white cells as well. And it seems like in her group of her specific gene deletion, those kids seem to almost always have a neutropenia. So I think it goes along with that gene deletion. But so there's various other additions, but at the bottom kind of common line with all of them is that they don't make any red cells.
How old is Olive now and where is she?
So she's 2.5. She's at home at the moment. I can't believe she's 2.5. We've got a new nanny who's looking after her. So because we moved. And so that was a really big challenge. I think that's, you know, we were so blessed as well with our nanny in Cape Town. She kind of also came to us like from heaven. She was working down the road from us and my husband kind of met her in the street one day and had a chat to her and said, oh, my wife's pregnant. We're looking for someone. So she took his number and said, I'll let you know if I have a friend or whatever. And she phoned him a few weeks later to say that the family she was working for were immigrating and she needed a new job. So she started with us just before Olive was born. So she was with us from the very beginning when Olive was well and when Olive was not well. And it was amazing. After 4 months, I went back to work off on maternity leave. And she really just got on board. I think at first she was a bit nervous, you know, when Olive was really so sick. But she just took it on and she really did so much more than probably was expected of her. She gave Olive her daily medication. She would phone me if she was worried about anything. She used to record daily temperatures at times when she was, you know, really having lots of infections. And in Olive's first year, I think we spent almost 140 days in hospital. So we really were very, very blessed to have her so competent and just willing to get involved, you know. And she really made my life manageable. I would not have coped without her.
What is your day-to-day life like? Like, are we allowed to pick her up? Is she walking? Is she talking? Is her development the same as another 2.5-year-old? Is she sensitive to touch? Is she like the bubble baby, you know, where we have to keep her separate from other children? Is bath time normal or your normal?
Exactly. So this is the thing, you know, this is my first baby, so it's all normal for me. But no, it's not really normal at all. We've been very isolating her a lot, you know. We don't want her to get sick. We have to prevent her from getting an infection. She had a few life-threatening episodes in her first year. Something that we changed was we started adding a medication called Neupogen, which is a growth cell-stimulating factor, which promotes production. Her bone marrow makes white cells. It just doesn't kind of get out there into the bloodstream. So it promotes production of neutrophils. We were only giving it at times when she had an infection, but we've started giving it now about 18 months ago, prophylactically. So she gets an injection for 3 days every 2 weeks, and that keeps her white cells at a more normal level, which I think has made a big difference. But other than that, we've got very strict kind of infection control measures at home, lots of hand washing. if I go out, you know, if I go to work, I come home and I change my clothes and I have a quick shower before I even pick her up because I don't want to bring all my hospital germs home. We hardly take her out. I mean, if I can count on my hand the times she's been grocery shopping with me. I really don't take her unless I absolutely have to. She comes out with us like to walk the dogs, you know.
She has a dog?
Yeah, we have two dogs. Those were our first two children. They were their first, shame.
Can she play with them?
She does. You know, even that, our dogs were really like in our beds kind of dogs before she was born. And then when she got sick, you know, unfortunately, we had to kind of put them out the house a bit and try and, you know, when she was still little and crawling, we could demarcate a space for her where they couldn't get into. That was like her room where she could play. But now that she's all over the place, it was a bit more difficult. Much, much easier now that she's walking and not crawling because she doesn't have her hands on the floor. But we just, we try to keep, you know, we have no shoes in the house and we try to keep the house as clean as we possibly can. It's really difficult with a toddler, you know, everything goes in the mouth and whatever. But she's actually quite good and she's very, we do wash her hands a lot and she'll come to me if she's got anything on her hands for a quick hand wash, you know. So she is definitely sensitive. You talked about the sensitivity issues. Another funny thing is if I try and put her on the grass, you know, she almost always had shoes on. So
I think that's a 2.5-year-old thing. They just want to be carried still. It's like, don't put me down.
But look, her development has been okay. Her gross motor development has definitely been slow. She only started walking when she was 2. I think because she's just a bit pup all the time, you know. She has these spurts. After her transfusion, she's so full of energy and I can't believe the growth in that week. And then for a few weeks, she kind of settles down and she's a bit quieter. So I think she just hasn't got the energy to build the muscle tone that she needs. But she's walking quite well now. She's running around. She's very small for her age. She's still wearing like 12 to 18 month size clothes. She loves books. She loves puzzles. She's talking well. So other than that, she's like a normal toddler.
How often does she need a transfusion?
Every 3 to 4 weeks. So her last transfusion was now 3 weeks. It'll be 3 weeks ago tomorrow. So I'm going to just start planning probably this afternoon or tomorrow. I'll start planning for her next one. It's quite a logistical thing.
How do they do it with a baby? Because, I mean, I've donated blood and I got a beautiful letter of how they say it's distributed and what they do with your blood. I've never received it. So is it the same procedure? She has to go into hospital and lie down and...
It basically comes in a little bag, like a normal, like a drip bag. And then she needs to have an IV line. So we put in a drip and then... It runs in over 4 to 5 hours. It's quite a slow process. She gets 15 mils per kg, so she's getting about 150 mils now. I said to you in the beginning she gets 100, she was getting 130. So for pediatric blood unit, they actually, when they take your blood, for an adult unit it's about 300 mils. They split it in half for two pediatric units. So one blood donation can actually go to two children or one adult, basically. But yeah, she gets 150 mils. So we actually just get it in one bag now, in an adult bag, and we discard what we don't use because it can't be reused once it's been radiated and what have you.
Because of your little daughter, you have now decided to help other people, other than the fact that both you and your husband are already in the line of service where you work with people and where you help others. Tell me about what you've done to make and create awareness about Diamond Black Fan anemia.
This was really the brainchild of my husband, who he worked so hard when Oliver first got sick just to try to get to the diagnosis for the first thing. You know, there's so much research and there just aren't a lot of resources. And even the, you know, the pediatric hematology is actually managed by oncologists in this country who are cancer doctors. It's not something that anybody's particularly an expert on that we could have been able to find, you know, in South Africa. So I think we're in quite a privileged position as doctors. You know, Colin went to the literature and he read the recent articles and he got the names of the doctors who are publishing these things and he emailed them and he said, look, I need to discuss with you about a patient with Diamond Black Fan anemia. And we were actually so amazed at the wonderful response. So we had several doctors, 3 or 4 doctors in the States and another doctor in the UK who were willing to Skype call with us and give us their opinions and advise us on further investigations and what we should do further. We met a doctor at Boston in the States, Professor Colin Seif, who is actually an ex-South African, and we actually met him. He came out to South Africa and he's been amazing support to us. He'll Skype Colin any day if he has a question, lots of advice. So it was quite a struggle, though, even, you know, for us as doctor parents to kind of make sure we were doing the right thing for our child. It was quite difficult to get that information. So his kind of dream was to put it together so that it's accessible in our setting, you know. What blood investigations should we do? How should we be managing it? How should we be transfusing? Because transfusion medicine is just a thing on its own. You know, there's different types of blood you can give. There's different ways of pre-treating the blood, different volume, you know, thinking about how much are you giving and how often. And those kinds of things are not necessarily, it's kind of like, it's a bit of finesse, you know, to try and know exactly for this child what's the best thing to do. So he put together kind of a protocol, which he drew from the American-based protocol and other research that he found. And then he felt, you know, we need to do something with this. So his initial kind of goal was to create a portal more for doctors and healthcare providers and patients where they can access information and kind of get a bit of a hotline to an expert when it's something that you don't really know about. And from that has also grown our frustration in terms of the actual treatment. You know, this for us is a very frequent event. And every time it's the same story. You go to the hospital and you're going to fill in that whole form. Are there any allergies? Do you have this? Do you have that? Have you been in the hospital before? Yes, several times, you know. So our kind of chatting about our kind of our wish was we wish there was a place we could just go, which was like a little home away from home, like just an infusion center, nice and easy. Pop up your everything sorted out beforehand. You know, everybody knows you. Pop up your drip, have your blood, and you go home. Like a day hospital kind of setting for a stable patient. So we started doing a bit of research into that, and that's kind of our ultimate goal is to create that kind of a space, because not just for children with Diamond Black Fan anemia, because there's not that many, but there are lots of similar conditions where children have chronic blood transfusions or chronic infusions or injections or something where they have to be in hospital for a few hours. And it takes a whole day. You know, for me, I miss a day of work. I've had to take unpaid leave for both of these last 2 years in spite of how generous all my employees have been with, you know, helping me out when needed, because it's kind of 15 transfusions. That's 15 hospital days just for her transfusions. So if there's any other days where she's not well, you know, to take out of that. As she gets bigger, it's going to take out of her school day, you know, or whatever. So to try and kind of streamline it. So that was kind of our goal, was this infusion clinic. So then we started our foundation, which we've called the Olive Children's Foundation, which kind of encompasses the whole lot. So it's really like creating a space, a doctor's portal, a more academic center where we're trying to put together a registry of patients. Having a registry just helps you to collate the data, to motivate for resources and protocols and to medical aids and stuff. If you can say, look, this is the need, then so we were trying to put a registry together. We trying to just be a bit of a support, a resource, having access to discuss with these experts overseas if somebody else would like a second opinion, you know. And then ultimately raising funds towards the development of this transfusion clinic and just creating awareness, and particularly about stuff like blood donation. I've been quite amazed at how the general public, there's a percentage of people who donate blood, and a percentage of people who don't even know anything about it, you know. There's a lot you can do for free, you know, to help other people. And so just trying to, you know, recruit people, educate people about issues around organ and blood donation as well.
This has been a life-changing moment for you. Not just having a baby, but having Olive.
Yeah.
How has this changed your life? And also, how has this changed your life as a doctor?
Let me answer the second part of your question first. I think I always like a compassionate doctor, but just it really has just changed my I know how it feels from the other side, you know what I mean? So you can be kind and caring to somebody, but knowing that how inconvenient it is to be admitted in hospital, or the other challenges, how it interrupts your daily life, or just other things that you might be feeling, you know, I think it's made me a lot more kind of empathetic towards my patient. It's really changed the way I also see medical care, you know. It's not just about here's a prescription, you know, it's about explaining this is how you take your prescription, you know what I mean, or whatever. Just so that the person knows, because you don't always take everything in at the first time either. When someone's telling you stuff, you get home and you think, oh, what was I supposed to do with this thing now, you know?
Sounds familiar.
Yeah. So just trying to engage with people on a more kind of personal level, I think, is the big thing for me. I've definitely struggled a bit more with peds. I used to love peds. But since I had a baby, I've definitely struggled a bit more with it, because I do get a little bit more emotional about it. So I found that a bit difficult. But But yeah, no, it's actually been, I think it's been a good experience for me as a doctor to be just a bit more compassionate about how this affects you and your circle, you know. As a mom, it's funny, you know, the thing is, people think, sure, I don't know how you've coped with this, but you actually have to. And I think that moms do, you know, and dads and grannies, you know, they think you can't cope with it, but you can always cope with it because you just have to for this little kid. You know, I've had times where I've thought, oh my gosh, this is just the worst. But then I think, look at Olive. She's actually the one who has to go through it. And she is. So we've all just got to get on board, you know. It's become our normal now, and it's a routine. It took a bit of time to get into a routine. I still hate it as the transfusion day looms. I think, oh, I should do this again. But it's just part of our day-to-day life. And I think it's made me a lot more, it's given me such a different perspective on life in general. You know, you can really fret about stuff like, I don't even know, what are they eating and can they cross the midline with their hands or are they sleeping right? Should I be sleep training her? Should I be putting her on solids? Can she have dairy? You know, you can really stress about stuff like that or not, you know, it's amazing how with a bit of perspective, the things that you worry about, you just don't kind of sweat the small stuff. So yeah, I think that's changed for me a lot. I've in a weird way, I have become a much less anxious person because things don't worry me as much as they used to because it's not worth worrying about those things. You know what I mean? Yeah. Well, exactly. You know, if it's not like a life and death issue, I actually am not going to worry about it, you know? So yeah, it's definitely changed my perspective on life in general, but it's been a good experience for me in the long run, you know, but yeah.
Have you met other mommies with children with Diamond Black Fam anemia?
Actually, amazingly, we met a young girl in Bloemfontein just after we arrived. She's actually a young adult now, she's in her 20s, and I met her parents. And that's we've met another girl similar age in Cape Town and another little girl who's about 2 years older than Olive. It's so inspirational to see them. And it's kind of like, you know, they're not people that we've known before. But you see them and you think immediately, you know, you have this huge thing in common and you know exactly what the other person's life is like. And it's quite encouraging, you know, to see how they've been carrying on, especially the parents of these older girls, you know, because at the time when their kiddies were little and sick and diagnosed, there was even less known about it. The medication, for example, that Olive takes to help to get rid of her excess iron because of her transfusions, that's kind of only been available for the last sort of 20-something years. You know, it was still experimental at the time when their little ones needed it. So they've been through a lot more in many ways than we have. And so it's quite encouraging, you know, to chat and see them. But on the other hand, you know, there's a big international community with DBA. There's kind of a big support group. So I've been in contact via social media with some of those parents. On the other hand, it's sometimes too much because some of the kids don't do well. Recently, there's actually been a few really, really sad things. There was a little boy, same age as Olive, who died in the middle of February. And that kind of thing is really like, it kind of, you don't know them at all, but you just feel like, oh, it's a huge loss, you know. It can also be quite hard to see them all struggling, you know, because it could be any of us. But definitely we encourage each other, I think, and give each other good support and advice. And I think that's what we'd like to create locally, you know, as part of our foundation, just to be able to be there for each other, you know.
Do children with this kind of anemia have a life expectancy?
It's also very variable. You know, when she was first diagnosed, we kind of researched a little bit and we kind of found like, for Olive's particular condition, it was like about 4 years old. But I think it's so dependent on the treatment and complications. You know, at the moment, she gets blood transfusions frequently. So that's not without risk. She is at risk of developing iron overload, which deposits iron in the liver and the pancreas and the heart, which can cause liver, heart, pancreas failure. So she takes medication daily to keep that under control. And at the moment, it's under control. But that medication that she takes can also cause deafness and blindness and renal failure. So if she starts complicating from her medication that we can't give her that medication, then it means that we start struggling with blood transfusions, you know. If everything goes well, then they can live on into adulthood. and many of them do. Some of these children are on steroids. They take various doses of steroids as low as possible. Some of them, when they start taking steroids, it kind of kickstarts the bone marrow to produce some red cells. Olive has had 2 steroid trials, when she was 1 and when she was 2, and there was no improvement. So we think she has a non-steroid responsive form of DBA. Ultimately, at the moment, the only kind of cure for the bone marrow failure is a stem cell transplant, where they subject the patient to chemotherapy, which kind of nukes out their entire immune system, and then give them someone else's stem cells or bone marrow to repopulate their bone marrow and produce healthy cells. So it's also a very high-risk procedure, you know, because they also get complications of the medication that they have to take for the transplant. They get infections with like a flu or a cold or something very minor, and it just knocks them out because they've got no immune system. So it's a very high-risk procedure, not something that you would want to undertake unless you don't really have an option, you know, like, for example, if you are not able to get your iron under control or whatever. There's some research. It's also very experimental on gene therapy. So it hasn't been done in a patient with DBA before. And that's another one of Colin's passions. He's trying to see where he can get someone to do some research on gene therapy in DBA. There's been some human trials done now in sickle cell anemia and other bigger, more common conditions. But that would essentially be curative of the syndrome as a whole because it would repair the gene deletion. So that's kind of the only ultimate cure. But as I say, still very experimental. We don't know what the long-term effects of that would be. So at this stage, it's really variable. They can die all of a sudden from something like an infection or a complication, or they can go on to live quite a normal, relatively normal, healthy life, you know, into adulthood. Yeah.
What gets you going every morning? How do you know that everything's going to be fine? I've met you, and you're, even though I can't see you today and you're far away in Bloemfontein and I'm sitting this side, what keeps you positive every single day? How do you stay up?
Olive is just about the happiest person I've ever met. You know, she's always been a happy baby. She like when she has her drip put in, she cries while they're putting the drip. She doesn't put it on away. She cries. When it's in, she knows it's in, and she gives everyone a high five, and she's happy. She wakes up in the morning with such a big smile on her face that, like, I can't not be, you know what I mean? My husband is also amazing. He's such a go-getter person. He works so hard all the time. He's always got something on the go. Work, his own work, which is a completely different line of work, as well as the DBA work, as well as family stuff. So, you know, it's kind of like you have to do it for them, you know what I mean? Like, it's easy to do it because that's what's happening in our household. Do you know what I mean? Everybody's just taken by the horns and we're just going with it. And we just try and have to keep things as happy and as kind of positive as we possibly can, because there is no point in moping about it, you know. It is what it is, and we've got to do it, and we've got to try and also enjoy our lives and be happy and make the most of our lives, you know what I mean? So we kind of we just get on with it.
Where can we learn more about the foundation that you have created?
So we have a website, olivechildrensfoundation.org. And we also have a Facebook page, and we'd love you to follow us on Facebook. We post all of our recent kind of blogs and updates on the website as well on our Facebook page. So that's probably the best place to start. And you please feel free to email us or send us an inbox message if you want more info or want to find out, you know, what are we doing and how people can get involved or whatever. Yeah.
Would you have another baby?
We'd like to. Yeah. We've both always wanted a big family. So it's our plan. We'd like to have another baby. I'm nervous about it. Not because of anything, except I'm like, oh, this one just got a little bit independent now. I don't really want a newborn, but no, we definitely do. Yeah.
You know, I listened to your story and having met you and heard your husband speak and seen Olive's pictures, I'm so glad that you are her mom. I'm so glad that you are her mom and that your husband is her dad, because you're not just helping your own baby, but you're helping so many other people, you know?
No, I'm also happy that we are her mom and dad, because she's an awesome kid, and I feel like we can. It's difficult because I'm always on the fence about our personal life, sharing our personal life too much, but it's important, and we can make a difference, you know, and maybe 100 years from now, something that we did will have paved the way for an easier path for people, you know, with the same things. So
I can tell you that 10 minutes after this podcast, you've done something for someone out there. It doesn't have to be 100 years because you're doing phenomenal, phenomenal work. I am so encouraged and inspired by what you do and how you're sharing your story. And thank you so much for motivating moms and moms-to-be and dads. And we will. We'll put up your information on our websites and we'll spread the news. And we wish you only the best. Many blessings and prayers and good health living with Olive.
Thank you so much, Alana, and thanks so much for having me. I've really enjoyed chatting with you, and it's been great.
For more inspirational stories, babybrunch.co.za. Click on our podcasts and listen to other ordinary moms who are sharing their extraordinary stories of how they're changing the world bit by bit. You that's changing the world.
Baby Brunch is made just for you by Bright Rock. Becoming a parent changes everything, from your sleep schedule to your finances. That's why BrightRock's Needs Match Life Insurance lets you precisely craft a solution to cover your specific needs. From protecting your income to covering your debts and your child's future. Because you pay just for the cover you need, you can get up to 40% more cover. So get the first ever Needs Matched Life Insurance that changes as your life changes. Go to brightrock.co.za. BrightRock Life is an authorized financial services provider and registered insurer. Terms and conditions apply.